This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. We continue our report back now from the Alight, Align, Arise conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia this past June, organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. As the conference's media partner, Yes Media spoke with prominent organizers and activists, among them Dreesen Heath, co-founder of the Why We Can't Wait Coalition. Dreesen is a reparatory justice expert who has previously led Human Rights Watch's domestic research and advocacy on reparations and reparative justice, and documented conditions of pervasive inequality and structural violence stemming from the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, one of the worst incidents of racial violence in U.S. history. She has also worked as a special assistant to the director and counsel of the Brennan Center's Washington, D.C. office, and was a researcher at the Center for Research in Education and Social Policy. Here's my conversation with her from Atlanta.
I'm Dreesen Heath, and I am a reparations activist, researcher, organizer in the movement that supports communities from local to the federal level on reparatory justice legislation. I've worked at Human Rights Watch for 5 years, and I have since moved on from Human Rights Watch, continued a number of those themes and projects of the momentum and building that I did there, and am continuing that in a new capacity just within myself now.
So you had an opportunity, I imagine, while at Human Rights Watch to be able to put into a global context the harm of slavery, of Jim Crow segregation, and all of the subsequent harms here in the United States along racial lines. How do you, can you convey that to us, putting that into the global perspective alongside human rights violations that are happening elsewhere?
The right to reparation is clearly outlined in international human rights law, as is the right to health, the right to education, the right to freedom of movement. And reparations is a part of that global fight, right, to rectify these violations when they do occur. And so situating reparations as a global argument, as a global movement, also recognizes the massive nature to which the transatlantic slave trade, trans-Pacific slave trade occurred, right? And has manifested in its neo-colonialist and current Jim Crow-like ways. And so it is important to not only hold the U.S. accountable within that sphere of other countries have taken steps to rectify their wrongs, such as Germany related to the Holocaust, right? One of the most comprehensive reparations programs we have. When we had Holocausts in the United States against Black people, genocidal acts against Black people, thousands of massacres, the transatlantic slave trade itself was an institution of deprivation, of degradation, of death. And continuing on today to police killings of Black people disproportionately, of a lack of access to resources and a starving of resources in Black communities, which have contributed to lower life expectancies, to PTSD, to higher rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality, right? So this is a global issue. It's one that I wish countries would galvanize and reckon with as it pertains to the U.S., because I think if we are able to see some tangible movement here for people of African descent, for Black people in particular, right? We've seen the U.S. take steps to rectify wrongs for other communities. There are reparations programs that exist today, such as the 9/11 Victims Restitution Fund or the PACT Act, which gives veterans who were exposed to toxic wastewaters compensation, as well as mental health programming, right? We have Black communities all across the country that have been exposed to toxic wastewaters. Where are the reparations there? And so using these global examples and the examples that the U.S. has already done to actually develop a comprehensive federal reparations program and then address at the local and institutional levels as well harms that were committed by those institutions.
You authored a Human Rights Watch report, The Case for Reparations in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a human rights argument that was in 2020. How does the Tulsa Race Massacre, as it's called, how is it a case study for reparations? This was a report in 2020, but, you know, I imagine there hasn't been much movement in the last 3 years on it.
You know, there... Sorry, let me start that over. An emotional question for me. When I wrote The Case for Reparations in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Human Rights Argument, I wrote that report and it was released 3 days before George Floyd was murdered. And that was a time in which not only was I presenting this major groundbreaking case of research connecting the massacre, the 1921 massacre, to present day harms, and arguing that there is a continuing massacre on the Black community in different forms. They've tried to, the city of Tulsa, the state of Oklahoma, have tried to destroy the Greenwood community and the descendants over decades, over time, right? Then fast forward to where I am releasing the report. And I'm not only, you know, preparing for this groundbreaking report, but I'm also in the streets. And that pressure and that realization that reparations is in the now. It is also for the past, but it is also in the now. And so that work is near and dear to my heart. I am recently returning from Tulsa after a long trip there as I spend the commemoration anniversary of the massacre there every year, May 31st, June 1st. Tulsa is a case study for reparations across the U.S. You have pre-massacre enslavement. You have the re-enslavement of a number of these Black communities. Then you have a violent race massacre, but then you have highway construction, and you have abusive eminent domain, and you have the relocation and displacement of Black communities further outside of Greenwood, where, you know, descendants and the broader Black community can no longer live in these areas that were once of culture, of joy, of life, of prosperity. And so when I look at Tulsa, I'm looking at the rest of the country. And I'm looking at the rest of the world. I think of the through line, again, I named enslavement, massacre, highway construction, displacement. But then you have, you know, the killing of, for instance, Terrence Crutcher in 2016 by Tulsa police. This is the same police department, the same institution that was culpable in the massacre, right? So perpetuating these same crimes once again against the Black community. And so what does it look like to get it right in Tulsa? I believe if we don't get it right in Tulsa, we can never fully rectify the wrongs, even at the federal level.
Well, speaking of the federal level, you were among those who testified to Congress for H.R. 40, the bill that would establish a commission examining reparations. What was that like? What were some of the issues you raised? What did you want members, our lawmakers, to know about the case for reparations and making H.R. 40 a reality?
My central message to lawmakers is that there is a right to reparation that the U.S. needs to abide by. Right. We have, as a country, we've ratified into two treaties, one that covers political and civic rights, the other that is specifically targeted towards eliminating racial discrimination. Right. The U.S. has responsibility under these treaties to do so, but also has a moral responsibility. It should to take care of all of its people. And so my central message was connect the dots. Do you want to continue to deprive marginalized communities at the expense of your own economy, right? At the expense of those people, first and foremost, but also at the expense of your own economy? We're not just saying we're going to push this to the side, right? You have never heard anyone related to the Holocaust besides Holocaust deniers say, we're just going to get over it. Right? Slavery, Jim and Jane Crow, war on drugs, housing discrimination, police violence, maternal mortality, never again. We should have the same motto and the same vigor around never again for these crimes as well. And I'd like to add that, you know, H.R. 40 has been introduced for over 33 years, first introduced after the Civil Liberties Act, which granted reparations and other remedies to Japanese Americans who were wrongfully incarcerated in World War II. 1 year after that legislation passed, there was a glimmer of hope. But here we are 33 years later, and the federal government has refused to even set up a study to produce recommendations. And so the stakes are too high to just sit around for a commission. We believe deeply in that investigative work and what it will unearth, and the process of community input actually and community driven work actually resulting in reparations proposals. But we also need more bites at the apple, right? This is a massive crime that we're trying to rectify. And so, you know, I am so grateful to the leadership of Congresswoman Cori Bush out of Missouri, who really believed that there needed to be something else on the table here when we talk about reparations. And she introduced H. Res. 414, which is a resolution that outlines a comprehensive and holistic framework for a federal reparations program. It's the first time a framework for reparations for the legacy of slavery has ever been introduced into the congressional record. And so I am, you know, partnering with her in this work, trying to galvanize more support. But also that resolution does something important of distinguishing what reparations is and what it isn't, right? And distinguishing the government's responsibility from just ordinary public policy, social policy, development aid that they should be giving to people anyway, right? Even though we know historically Black communities have been disinvested in, it separates that from the repair mechanisms that need to also accompany that good public policy. And so I'm excited for what's to come with this resolution. It is both an education tool, but also a mobilizing tool, right? This is also the first time we've actually named an at minimum compensation number when it comes to reparations, right? A number that respective scholars have been floating around for years around just treating the racial wealth gap of $14 trillion. But that resolution specifically says at minimum, because we know that the economic, psychological, political, social harms extend far beyond $14 trillion. And so I'm just excited that in this particular moment in the movement, right, where there's a lull, where there's not just, you know, the passive language that the media says around H.R. 40 is stalling. H.R. 40 is being intentionally blocked. And as someone who has helped whip those votes for that bill, I know what the deal is. And so no community in this country has ever won reparations without more than one proposal on the table. And so we're adding more skin in the game and really trying to push this, not just this conversation forward, but putting pressure on actual action.
If reparations were to move forward, or at least the movement to reparations were to move forward with a commission and maybe someday some actual tangible, reparative resource, money, whatever, how does that go hand in hand with stopping the harm? Because as you pointed out, police violence is a continuation of all of the harms. Do you see this movement for reparations then linked to, for example, the abolition movement?
Absolutely. So the UN lays out five forms of reparations that most organizations and movement leaders organize around, right? So that would be restitution, return of land, return of property, return of artifacts, compensation, economically assessable damage, but also a calculation of moral and spiritual loss to connections to land and community, rehabilitative measures, satisfaction measures, official apologies that are naming culpability, but also this key factor of guarantees of non-repetition. And what does that mean? That means this abuse shall never happen again. We will not commit this kind of abuse on this category of people or an individual again. And when you look at things like the policing institution, like the criminal legal system, these are central questions of, has this system been set up to function in the way that it has been set up? It has, right? To criminalize and to further dehumanize Black people, to make it a separate class of people, a separate way of living. And so is that institution itself healthy? No. And so what does that mean? That means we need to be thinking about institutional and legal reforms. And that requires us to think deeply about the steps towards abolition.
What will it take to get things from a theoretical discussion level into reality? I mean, obviously, it's a huge question. And you just outlined the very many facets of what reparations actually looks like. But from your perspective, what is the sort of action that you are focused on to making reparations a reality today?
I'm focused on building within the diaspora, building back from trauma. I'm focused on making these things an actual possibility, right? We have seen reparation routinely done by the federal government, by state governments, but we have not seen that for Black people. And so what I'm focused on is eradicating anti-Blackness at every point and turn. We cannot continue to say this is an uphill battle, that this is some possibility, right? This should be all the possibility. This should be the world we want to transform into, one that is willing to, you know, hey, when you're in the schoolyard and you're, you know, in elementary school and you may have pushed someone down, right? The teacher comes over and says, come up and apologize and rectify that relationship. We're looking for not just apology, beyond apology, but the changing of these material conditions. We've seen the government print money overnight. We've seen the government ship billions overseas, right? In situations for which need to also be remedied. However, we're saying remedy us at home. Remedy us in a way where we know we're approaching 2045, 2050, when the demographics are going to change, when the marginalized are going to become the majority. And if the harms are not ceased prior to that moment, we're going to have the continued perpetuation intergenerationally of this trauma and this harm. And I can't stand for that. I know the people I'm building with can't stand for that either. It's very possible. It takes morality. It takes will. It takes going against the status quo. And it takes a bit of sacrifice and a lot of integrity to make this happen.
Well, finally, Dreesen, how do you make the case that reparations can benefit the country as a whole? Because that's seemingly going to be the biggest obstacle, is convincing, especially white America, that reparations can actually be something that they can embrace.
If I'm being honest, I do not have a great concern of, do white people support reparations for Black people? That is not my central focus. And why that's not my central focus is because no one polled the Black community when they ran the highways through our communities. No one polled the Black community when they decided to legalize chattel slavery. No one, you get what I'm saying? No one polled us when we were lynched and hanging from trees. And so I don't care what white America says about this. I don't care what the institutions say about this. There is a responsibility that needs to be abided by. and there is accountability in all forms that are necessary, right? We all believe in rehabilitation. We would not see doctors if we didn't, right? And you may experience a tear in your Achilles or a broken ankle. And those are two different harms that were occurring that need two different treatments. White America, Black America, everyone has to get behind that rehabilitation, right? Because the injury only gets worse. And we've seen that. We've seen that decade after decade. It is not enough to just, you know, smooth over the wound. It needs to be stitched up in a way that is towards a pathway to healing. And not just, you know, this surface level healing, like some true accountability on, hey, so what if my own individual family did not contribute to this? You are benefiting from those spoils today. And that is, and that is really the, you know, that's the crux of the issue. And that's what we're trying to present here. But you have even Citigroup, who is a child of a parent bank that was involved in the slave trade, that are producing studies post the murder of George Floyd that are saying the U.S. economy lost $16 trillion just in two decades because of anti-Black discrimination and housing and employment and job creation, right? And so if we're willing to cost the economy at the expense of just a few who will get wealth off of Black exploitation, right? Because that's essentially what you're asking here, is more of a question about what is democracy, mm-hmm. and how are we going to actually fulfill that, right? In the U.S., democracy is an unfinished project. We've never fully recognized that because we've never fully had equal standing. And so what does it look like to realize reparation in the interest of actually establishing a functioning democracy?
Thank you so much. Wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dreesen Heath, reparatory justice expert with the Why We Can't Wait Reparations Coalition, during a recent conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia, produced for Yes Media, where I work as an editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.